Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This program is brought to you from the Margaret Farrow Studio.
This week on Rewind, your week in review. Republicans take the state superintendent to task while she pushes back against misinformation. Plus, the Wisconsin Supreme Court's Chief Justice says threats against judges should be a bipartisan concern. And lawmakers hear testimony about enshrining a definition of anti-Semitism into law. All that and more on Rewind, your week in review for October 24th.
I'm Ani Van Wagtendonk.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
Welcome back, J.R., and
Thank you. Happy birthday.
Great to have you on Rewind. We are starting with a kind of heavy and ongoing story that you missed in your absence, which was this Cap Times report looking into allegations of sexual misconduct among teachers. A Cap Times investigation found that between 2018 and 2023, 200 teachers, subs, administrators, et cetera, were investigated for misconduct among students, and some proportion of them were allowed to give up their licenses rather than continue that investigation. So Jill Underley was invited to an informational hearing this week in front of the Assembly Government Operations Accountability and Transparency Committee, also known as GOAT, an informational hearing. She did not attend. She was receiving an award from your shared alma mater, I understand, Indiana University, but said, DPI takes this very seriously. She released her own statement saying that there were, that the story misstated certain things, that there was a lot of misinformation going around. But we have a little bit of video coming out of that committee hearing to kind of look at both sides of this argument.
I don't understand where there's confusion. Do we have to explicitly write the word grooming in this law to spell out that grooming is not commonly accepted moral and ethical standards? And I see a letter that's published publicly by the state's top education person who other school districts look to for guidance on how they're going to execute these investigations saying, I'm not sure if grooming's covered or not. I'm not sure if professional boundary violations are something we can look at or not. We kind of do sometimes, but because it's not in the law, maybe we don't.
When we find these things, we go after them. What I'm trying to explain to you both is that when we are dealing in a place where the behavior, as you heard law enforcement say, presents challenges about what is the line and where is the line, the department using all of its authority to put its foot down on these cases and revoke licenses, we're doing that in a space right now where the authority doesn't necessarily purely back us in every instance. We're still doing it. But you're asking us to make judgment calls about a vague and ambiguous statute?
So a little bit of that back and forth, but there was really kind of bipartisan, I think, frustration with Underley expressed at that committee. And so all together, both Democrats and Republicans, they voted unanimously to ask Josh Call to look into this question of whether grooming is kind of covered under the state law that says how teachers can and can't interact with students, basically whether misconduct rules apply, like includes this idea of grooming. GOP lawmakers are also trying to enshrine a definition of grooming into law, so they've proposed that bill. And then Republican Congresspeople have also responded. Tom Tiffany said, you know, this is unacceptable, both from Underley and Governor Evers for not making a statement. Four Republican Congresspeople have written a letter to Evers to investigate this. And so it's really been this quite significant kind of political moment.
So look, bad stories are part of being in public office. You're going to get them. How you respond to them is a measure of your leadership and your mettle. Jill Underley is failing on all accounts so far politically in how she's responded to this thing from everybody I've talked to. So now let's give her some benefit of the doubt. If you're talking about in the weeds policy about how things operate with the agency, the people who, you know, the bureaucrats might be the best position to answer those questions, okay? Two, there may be some things that DPI is handcuffed by in state law. I mean, let's be honest. If there is a teacher who is touching a student appropriately, the local district is going to investigate it first, right? There'll be a call to the police. There's going to be publicity about it. So, you know, there are those kinds of things. Okay, those are the benefit of the doubt things. The political reality is you have this controversy that is threatening the foundation of your, you know, standing with the public, and you went out of town. Now, I get it. It's a Distinguished Alumni Award from the College of Arts and Sciences at Indiana University. It's a big deal. I think there are 3 selections this year. There's a panel discussions involved in all the whole nine yards. This is your day job, right? This is like your important thing. You're an elected official who's accountable to the voters, sponsor agency. The fact you wasn't there is a problem. Now, beyond that, there's a political angle to it, as there always is. Tom Tiffany is not picking up on this issue just because he's a congressman. He is running for governor. He wants to make this an issue, and you've seen already in some tweets, like trying to do the Evers, Underly, Barnes, Rodriguez administration. What he's doing there, or before he's doing there, is trying to link Governor Evers to Jill Underly, then to Mandela Barnes, who we think is going to run for governor at some point, announce that, to Sarah Rodriguez, lieutenant governor, who is running for governor. They want to make this a problem for Democrats in general. They are not doing enough to protect kids. They also want to link it from that to transgender issues, to reading scores, that Democrats are failing education. Because any poll you look at shows you that Democrats have an edge on education when it comes to the voters' views. Voters just say Democrats care about education. Republicans care about smaller government. That's just the way it is in polling. Republicans need an opportunity here. They are going to seize upon it and try and drive this issue that, hey, these folks over here are not doing enough. You need to give it back to us, the governor's office, to take care of things.
Yeah, and student safety is obviously one of these issues that everybody kind of agrees about. They don't necessarily agree on the details of kind of how to make that happen, but it becomes a helpful wedge issue if you are kind of in the minority on education issues. And of course, the Republican-backed superintendent candidate did kind of the best of a non-Democratic-backed candidate in however many years. And so they are sort of finding some areas to kind of get a stronger footing on politically when it comes to education.
So for Underly, what's next? How do they right this ship? There are going to be bills that are going to come forward. Governor Evers, by the way, has been pretty silent about this. I asked his office for comment about that letter, asking him basically for an investigation. Now, the governor does not have investigative powers. You'll check the Wisconsin Constitution, but he can use a bully pulpit. He was a former DPI superintendent. The range studied includes his last year in that office. So, you know, there are some questions you can ask about Tony Evers. He's been pretty quiet about it so far. But for Underly, she won in 2024. I'm losing track of my years here. So, she's running re-election. The next election is 3 years from now. Will people remember this 3 years from now? Or what about the reading scores? What about, there are all these things. Is she going to run again for re-election? What does she want her legacy to be? How is she going to run this agency? Can she do it effectively if this is what's going on and how she responds? Now, there will be more chances for her to respond. We have 2 hearings coming up in early November. One, John Jagler, Republican from Waterford, Senator, Chair of the Senate Education Committee, has another informational hearing. The only invited speaker is going to be Jill Underly. 2, the Joint Audit Committee is going to have a public hearing at the first week of November to approve an audit of this program to see what's going on with these licenses, suspensions, those kinds of things. So they're going to call her to testify as well. And DPI said that Underly will be at the Joint Audit Committee. Okay, she's got to come with the goods. She has to respond better than we've seen so far to address these questions, to get her footy back under politically with what's going on.
And some of the push-pull also is to do with funding, which is also one of these kind of partisan back and forth. And so Republicans, I think the immediate response from Speaker Voss was, rather than ask for more money, how about you kind of figure out this issue? And one of the things that DPI says is that they are a little hamstrung by a lack of funding. So, for example, only having one full-time investigator to look into these things. And so that not just being hamstrung by the letter of the law, but also just kind of not necessarily being able to move at a quick pace when it comes to dealing with these kinds of allegations. And so I think that money argument is also going to be kind of at the forefront.
And Republicans are saying, well, why didn't you ask for more in the budget? Like, where was the request, not just for an overall budget increase, but for this particular program? You know, where was that money? Where was that request?
Yeah, so we'll keep an eye on that. And then speaking of funding for education, there was the closure of another 2-year branch campus in the UW system. So UW-Platteville closed its Baraboosock County, or announced that it will be closing its Baraboosock County campus at the end of this school year. So this was announced last Friday. Chancellor Tammy Avedovich said that enrollment continues to decline on that campus. We are committed to being good partners with the city and county by ensuring the campus can be used in ways that best serve the region, and we will support our students, faculty, and staff through the transition. So this is a pretty surprising, like, late Friday afternoon announcement. It comes as enrollment has declined across these 2-year campuses. And just, I think, 2 or 3 years after in-person classes ended at the Richland Center campus of UW-Platteville as well. And so there's been all of these changes to these two-year campuses. Last year, the Sauk County Board floated almost $400,000 for maintenance on the campus. And so when I hear, you know, we're committed to being good neighbors, that's what I hear is, to what extent can we be going to these local communities for money to help out with, you know, landscaping on these campuses that have an enrollment half of what was projected for the year. But then you also hear from a lot of these rural communities that these are these kind of lifeline institutions to get people into trades or into professions or into four-year institutions. And so there's been, again, this kind of question about higher education funding at play here.
Look, this was the access point to UW for a long time for kids who maybe weren't ready for one of the four-year campuses. The issue, though, is we've seen overall a blurring of lines between the two-year campuses and the technical colleges. As a parent of a college student and one who looked at various options, I can tell you, you can go to Madison Technical College right now and do 2 years there, get a certain GPA, and transfer to UB-Madison from MATC. It's a pretty good deal. I looked at the tuition dollars. It's a pretty good deal. There are more access points to these tech colleges. So these campuses have struggled to find what is their role in the overall system. There's also a question of what's the right size of UW overall. If you look at the trends, demographic trends in Wisconsin, we are producing fewer high school kids. There are fewer high school kids and fewer looking at college as an option post-high school. You're going to have a decline in enrollment. There's an issue there. So these things are going to struggle for a while. This is not going to be the last campus of these to close, I'm going to guess right now.
Yeah, I think out of the 13 UW two-year campuses, there are just 5 that are continuously operational in the way that they have been for, I believe, 70 years or mm-hmm. so. So I think this has been part of a kind of ongoing trend. Another upsetting trend, threats against judges. So this week, Chief Justice Jill Karofsky, charges were brought against a man who is accused of stalking her, emailed her numerous times, emailed the Office of Lawyer Regulation numerous times with complaints against her, to the point that she says that she was afraid. She asked for police presence, you know, when going to public sporting events. This man has been, while he's facing trial, told to stay away from her, from the Office of Lawyer Regulation, from Dane County as a whole. But it speaks to, again, this kind of broader trend of threats against judges. Federal judges have faced, I think, a doubling of threats in a two-year period. In Wisconsin, the numbers from the first 3 months of 2025 are almost equivalent to the numbers for the entire year of 2024. Mm-hmm. And so there's been attempts federally and then on various state levels to kind of increase security for judges. And here there have been at least 2 attempts in my short time in Wisconsin to increase security for Wisconsin Supreme Court justices, first brought by Annette Ziegler, a conservative, after a Circuit County judge was murdered in his home. In 2023, she made that ask. And then earlier this year, again, they made that ask for, I believe, $1 million for a special security force for Supreme Court justices. That was denied. That was endorsed by Evers, denied by JFC. And so now they have this kind of 4-person branch of the Capitol Police that's meant to just heighten security for judges across the state. But that's paid for with COVID dollars that are due to expire next August. And so there is this kind of broader question about violence against judges and how to be dealing with that right now.
Republicans have looked at this twice, and their response is, we're not going to create a police force for the Supreme Court, essentially. There are resources like Capitol Police that can do this. Now, Karofsky, during lunch that we had this week, said she's confident she can secure dollars to provide this enhanced security. So right now, the court has what's approved with state funding. It's 1.6 full-time equivalent positions. So one full-time position and a 0.6, okay, for the marshal's office. They have 4 Capitol Police officers approved with these federal COVID funds. The Office of Marshals that was proposed would have added, sorry for these decimals, 8.4 full-time equivalents. So basically 10 people who would be in this office to not only take care of the Supreme Court, but also to talk about court security across the state. They could go into Dane County or Barron County or Brown County and say, okay, you guys, here's your vulnerability. Here's what you could do. Karofsky was saying that the 4 they have right now from Capitol Police, they are helpful, can go other places and help, but they want to have a permanent, you know, a bolstering of what's going on. To your point, I actually pulled these numbers here real quick. In 2022, there were 30 credible threats passed on law enforcement against members of the judiciary in Wisconsin. It jumped to 46 in 23, 29 and 24, and just through March of 22. Now, we have through March numbers because the Fiscal Bureau prepared all these numbers about this proposal for the budget liberation. So that's all I had through March. So 22 through March. And Kurofsky talked at luncheon about the uptick after 2020. What's happened since 2020? Well, the claims about the 2020 election from Donald Trump, his supporters, that was stolen, there was fraud, et cetera, talked about ad nauseum. That has led to an increase. Part of what's driven the increase in threats against the judiciary because of this perception that the judiciary is out to get Donald Trump.
Yeah, the threats against Kurofsky, the alleged threats, I should say, came from a person with, it seemed like, a sort of personal grudge against the attorney who represented him in a domestic abuse case. But often they are kind of motivated by these broader claims. And, of course, we have these very heated Supreme Court elections. And so the rhetoric gets quite heated about who these people are, these kind of nameless people in robes, you know, somewhere. And so it can lead to this really kind of very tense moment. Turning now to the legislature. A number of things are kind of floating around, but we picked two this week that we thought were particularly interesting that there was some action on. So we talked about a cannabis bill a couple of weeks ago. It's the latest attempt to get medical marijuana across the finish line. And they're moving kind of quickly on this. It had a hearing this week. How does it compare to kind of previous efforts from Republicans, and do you think it stands a chance?
First, it's largely similar. You know, does it stand a chance? Not likely. And this is why. There has been a philosophical difference between the Senate and the Assembly GOP about this issue for a while. Largely Robin Voss and the Senate co-sponsors. So Robin Voss, the Speaker, wants state-run dispensaries. He is adamant that we're not going to have just any willy-nilly licensee out in Wisconsin dispensing medical marijuana. The Senate Republicans say we are not going to increase the bureaucracy. We're not going to have a state office of pot, essentially. So until they figure out that issue, it's likely not going anywhere. Now, miracles do happen. This also has been a big change because if you go back 8 years when Scott Fitzgerald was still in the Senate, the majority leader, 6 years, he was like, medical marijuana? No way. There was no conversation about it. So there's progress. Robin first started talking this like 6 years ago, saying, look, with opioids, what's going on? I'm open to medical marijuana as an alternative to opioids being prescribed. That was a big wow moment. But we're a ways away from like actual marijuana, medical or otherwise, being legalized. Meanwhile, we have Democrats saying, this is not enough. They want full legalization. They say the polls support it, the governor support it. The governor's put it in his budget each of the last three times, at least, I think, something like that. So there is a philosophical difference between Republicans, legislature, and Democrats and everybody else about how to do this. And so right now, it's not looking great for getting it done.
The other bill that really kind of drew my attention and that I've reported on quite a bit is an effort to adopt a sort of a formal definition of anti-Semitism. It's one that was written enacted, I should say, by the International Holocaust Remembrance Association. And so this would be an effort to enshrine that into law here in Wisconsin. It's adopted by many countries and states, some college campuses as well. But there's a bit of a controversy in this idea that it could conflate criticism of the state of Israel with anti-Semitism. And so we have a little bit of video from a committee hearing about this earlier this week.
CAM's Anti-Semitism Research Center documented an alarming 6,326 anti-Semitic incidents in 2024, staggering 107.7% increase from 2023. When looking at the data from 2025, from January to August of this year, through August 31st, it's been a 10% increase from this point last year. This definition is clear, concise, vital resource to determine manifestation of anti-Semitism in all forms. In post-October 7th landscape of anti-Semitism, the examples encompass traditional anti-Jewish hatred, as well as Holocaust denial and outsized criticism of the State of Israel based on its Jewish foundations and character.
I have actively pursued combating anti-Semitism for my entire adult professional life. And frankly, nothing in this bill will have that result. Not a single jurisdiction that has adopted the IRA definition has seen any decline in anti-Semitic incidences. If you really want to do something to fight anti-Semitism, which I sincerely believe you want to do, or you wouldn't be here today, support a task force, a bipartisan task force, that would prepare a whole-of-state government approach to fighting hatred, including anti-Semitism.
Right, so kind of this complicated and nuanced conversation where the definition would, first of all, it would act as an add-on, so it would not actually kind of criminalize anti-Semitic speech, but if you do something that is otherwise seen as a crime and say something anti-Semitic, or if it's perceived as, you know, sort of violating some of these standards, then it could it function sort of as a hate crimes enhancer. Mm-hmm. And so that is one argument. The Jewish Federation of Milwaukee backs this, and they say they track anti-Semitic incidents in the state. They've tracked 700 in the last decade. They say that there is, you know, a rise, especially since the October 7th attacks, and that there is some of that kind of conflation of attacking people who have pro-Israel beliefs, you know, and so again, this kind of conflation there. And then what we also heard from a former leader of the Milwaukee Jewish Federation is that it could be used to kind of go after free speech or other types of activism. One concern in other spaces is that it could go after, you know, sort of pro-Palestinian activism. It could go after free speech on campuses. I actually interviewed a man who was one of the lead authors of the definition, and he now stands against that definition because he says it goes after free speech. And so it is this kind of complicated issue. So it'll be really interesting to kind of follow. At the same time, there's actually been an effort at the federal level to adopt this, and a number of Republicans have not supported it because one of the definitions of classical anti-Semitism is this idea that Jews are responsible for the death of Jesus Christ. And so a number of Republicans in Congress said, you know, would it criminalize certain Christian teachings? So this really complicated conversation. It's been really interesting to see that that argument play out in the legislature. And then a kind of final election-related bit of information. Eric Toney jumping back into the race for Attorney General. So it is looking like we might have a bit of a rematch of 2022. So the Fond du Lac District Attorney, he launched his campaign on Tuesday, really targeting Josh Call's record on crime, on opioids, on the state crime labs. And so depending on who else does or doesn't get in the race, we could just see 2022 all over again.
So the first question for Toney is, will he get a primary challenger? 3 years ago, Adam Jarko, who is a former state lawmaker, ran against Eric Toney saying this guy is not right for Republicans because he filed but then dropped charges for people who violated governor's original stay-at-home order back in during the COVID-19 early stage of the pandemic. He was adamant about going after Toney. I have not heard anybody else talk about running for this position actively. And the feedback I've gotten from Republican sources is that Eric Toney's been out there talking to the Lincoln Day dinners and the, you know, the various events and traveling all over Wisconsin to nail down the grassroots. So let's assume no primary challenge. Okay, next question is going to be, what's the environment next year? 3 years ago, you had Joe Biden in the White House, which usually is bad for the party in the White House, but Democrats had the Dobbs decision, which was a boost for the electoral chances. Toney fell short by 35,000 votes in that kind of environment. How strong is the gubernatorial candidate going to be for Republicans? Remember, Toney Evers won by 93,000 votes roughly in 2022. So Josh Call is running behind Toney Evers. Why? It could take us a while to figure that all out. But the fact is, Call has not had a dominant performance in elections so far. He narrowly beat Brad Schimmel back in 2018. So is he a stronger position now or a weaker one? Third, for Toney, do you nationalize this race in some way? Do you try to say, if I win, I will stop every lawsuit Josh Call has filed against Donald Trump because it's not good to go after the president and try and get Trump supporters excited? Will you try to not nationalize it and say, hey, Josh Call's too fascinated with the White House and what's going on there? I'm going to focus on the crime lab and illegal immigration and those kinds of things. Now, for Josh Call, running for a third term. A little tricky sometimes. Scott Walker ran for a third term and lost in 2018. Lots of factors why he did. Jim Doyle won three terms Attorney General. That was eons ago, 1998, won that third and final one. Tommy Thompson won four terms as governor. The last one was in 1998 as well. So it's been done. But that third time around can be a little bit of a tough one. So will Josh Call have a good environment because he's the incumbent, he's raised money, Republican in the White House? Will people go, not sure about 12 years, this guy? And then finally, Josh Call pass running for governor. And there's always a thing about the fire in the belly to talk about in politics. You know, did he have the fire to do it? So he didn't have the fire in the belly to run for governor. Does he have the fire to run for attorney general again? Like, how bad does he want this job again? Like, what's his path forward? So a lot of questions about this race, but a lot of it will be dictated by top of the ticket. So tell me who the gubernatorial appointees are or nominees are. That will tell me how to set this race a little bit just below them.
Right. Well, who will kind of inspire fire in the belly among voters? And normally that is more of a governor's level question than attorney general. Turning now to the Stock Report, yesterday the Senate invoked cloture on the nomination of Rebecca Tableson to the Seventh Circuit, setting up a confirmation vote on Monday. So she is rising this week.
Look, the vote is basically a formality now. After that nomination, that confirmation hearing, there was this whole to-do of, oh, look, these 50 conservative leaders signed this letter saying she's not good enough. She, oh my, she gave money to Act Blue that they said was earmarked for Joe Manchin, then the U.S. Senator from West Virginia. She gave money to a Jewish group in Milwaukee that they said was, you know, not good because it embraced homosexuals and transgender folks and those kinds of things. And she married a Democrat. These are all bad things in their eyes. Sorry to be flippant, but, you know, they were basically nitpicking why they think she shouldn't be on the court. There was some question, would there be another shoe to drop or something that would kind of cause problems? In the end, it was 50-45, that cloture vote. All Republican senators who voted for Tableson. It pretty much means she's going to glide through on Monday. Now, worth noting, Tammy Baldwin did not. The Democrat from Madison said, look, even though my commission that I jointly created with Ron Johnson forwarded her as a candidate at the White House, it wasn't an endorsement. That commission has three picks from Baldwin, three from Johnson. You have to have five votes of the six to advance. So Tammy's picks liked her at least, you know, at least a little bit. But Baldwin said she wouldn't support or affirm that she would uphold the decision from the Supreme Court that basically legalized gay marriage in this country. Gave me concerns about that and other things, so I couldn't vote for her. It's just interesting sometimes you have our senators who create this commission to identify candidates. The candidate gets picked and they vote against them. That happened with Ron Johnson. He blocked William Pocan, who was a judge from Milwaukee County, who was going to be on the bench in Green Bay. He blocked that pick. Timmy Ball dealt with Jordan Giamperto. I hope I said that correctly. Another one who emerged as a candidate, but she had concerns about him afterwards. So just an interesting dynamic. And bottom line is, for Rebecca, she's going to be in the court. Now, one thing to watch, though, did conservatives get their message across the White House of, okay, you have a young female judge who's going to be in the appeals court. That would only put you on the short list for the Supreme Court someday. You better not nominate her because she's got A, B, C, D, and E in her background. We would not be happy about that. That's something you kind of keep in the back of your mind.
Yeah, and one of the things that the Baldwin team told me is that, you know, it's important to kind of endorse the process of having that bipartisan nominating commission. That's different than endorsing the candidate. And so it's interesting to see, you know, kind of trying to follow these norms even in an unusual time. That brings us to mixed Derek Van Orden.
So we had fundraising numbers last week and a new poll out this week. The fundraising numbers, Derek Van Orden is raising good money, $1 million the latest quarter. He's one of four GOP incumbents in battleground districts to raise $1 million or more. Rebecca Cook, however, raised 900 some K, so she's right on his heels. Now, Rebecca still has a primary to worry about. The president of the Eau Claire City Council is running for the nomination as well. She raised 100 some thousand dollars. I don't diminish that kind of money, but when you've got this much versus this much, it tells you where the bets are being placed who's going to be the nominee for Democrats. For Van Orden, what's interesting is this poll. It's a Democratic poll. It's a poll a year after the election, so grains of salt galore. However, Van Orden's the only Republican in the delegation ran behind Donald Trump last fall in Wisconsin. In this poll, Trump was +2 for the entire district for his favorability rating. Van Orden's -10. So you again have that gap where he's running behind Trump. Now, why is that? We both know, because we're on social media constantly, that Derek Van Orden has a very bombastic personality, to put it nicely, on social media. People have told me before that when he goes in the district, he has a different kind of approach. He's much more personable and, like, you know, showing up all these events, that kind of thing. People have wondered, is that social media personality now seeping through in the district? They're going, you know, this guy's kind of, you know, a little jerky sometimes. I don't like it. I mean, we don't know for sure. Now, Van Orden, fast forward next fall, those Trump people who aren't really happy with him, will they come home once you put your partisan jersey on? It's election time. We'll see. But there's a warning sign there for him. If you're going to lag behind the president, you got some problems.
And then following this week, the state Republican Party treasurer, Kelly Rue, resigned. And so that leads you to call the state Republican Party falling.
Look, okay, we know they've got problems over there, all right, financially. But how bad is it when the person who sees the books and cashes the checks goes, this place is dysfunctional. I am out of here. She wrote this torching letter to the state GOP saying things are dysfunctional. There's no basically metric. There's no goal. We don't have things going well. And look, she's not some young rabble-rouser. There's this kind of new faction in the party of Turning Point USA people who've got a toehold with the party, who are being very critical of Brian Schimmel, the state PO chair, party as a whole, saying, we're losing. We've got to change things. OK, Kelly's been around for a long time, and there's a guy who's a Turning Point USA guy who kind of promoted or shared her letter, resignation letter, on social media a week ago, saying, look, we don't agree, but even she, the old guard, is saying there's a problem. So my questions are, okay, how do you fix it? We got new federal fundraising report numbers this week. They weren't great for the GOP again, outraised by the Democratic Party again. There's an election this spring for Supreme Court. If you're a Republican, you have confidence in the state GOP helping Maria Lazar, if she's the conservative nominee, in that race. Then you have a governor's race next fall. They are a big part of that. Like, there's not a lot of confidence right now in Republicans in the state GOP and how it's going to perform in 2026. They have to change something. What's that going to be?
All right, and that'll do it for us this big week at Rewind. I am Anya Van Wagtendonk.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
And we'll see you next week.
This program was brought to you from the Margaret Farrell Studio.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.